Hi, you're listening to CKLN Radio Special International Women's Day programming. We have here in the studio with us Fran Tababadong, Michelle Millard, and Lucy Costa. The number to call if you would like to ask questions is 416-595-1655. And we're talking about healing and recovery. And we're just going to talk a little bit about our concepts of healing, how we see healing, what kind of a process that is, what do we understand when we say healing. Who wants to start? Fran?
Yes, I would say what I've learned in the past 7 years on my own healing journey and working with the trauma facilitator for the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years is that healing is very hard work, and it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time because for a lot of the Aboriginal people, it took us a long time to get where we're at today, and it's going to take us a long time to heal. For example, myself, I've had 11 abusers under the age of 13. I'm 40 years old now, and it's taken me 7 years to come to terms with that. And going back and dealing with each issue and looking at physical damage that was done to my body and healing from that. And just giving that hope to people out there, especially the Aboriginal population, that there is hope and there's healing going on, and this is all starting to come out. And this model that we're using is ancient knowledge that's being brought back. And the challenge for me is to explain it in the English language. So... and also that healing, when we look at the human being, that we're connected to everything, the environment, the water, everything's all connected. Our self-worth, once we've obtained total self-worth, we then realize our connectedness to the universe and to the natural environment.
So Fran's describing a holistic model of healing. Is that something that you would support, Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, we all have our metaphors, right? And the one we use at CCVT is shadow of the eclipse. You relate in the shadow of the eclipse. And sometimes you see the light, which is the whole person, and sometimes you see the shadow. And it's always in flux. For us, healing is not forgetting. It's finding a way to integrate the experience into your life journey, really, because it's something that has happened, and you can't deny that it has happened. And you have to put it someplace, and put it someplace that you can still function, and more than function, to live. So yes, of course, you know, the holistic approach, I think, is the best approach, because you're dealing with a whole person.
Lucy, we were talking earlier as we were getting ready for this, and you were saying that as a psych survivor, you have, you know, the idea of healing is kind of mixed for you, you know, that maybe it's so laden with different meanings by the psychiatric system that it's not something that you would just embrace.
That's right. It's an issue of language and how language gets appropriated in different contexts, because I think psychiatry would say that it's in the business of healing and curing and making better, but for some of us, that's not the kind of healing we want. I think certainly for psych survivors, a lot of our healing stems from political change and being members and participating in political change. And it's hard for us to do that when so many of our rights get taken away from us. I guess I would say that that's where I sort of situate healing for me, is through political activism.
Just wanted to remind our listeners that if you'd like to speak with any of these panelists, or if you have something to say on the subject of healing from trauma, mental health, the psych system, different ways that people can come to peace with their past experiences, please do give us a call at 416-595-1655. We'd be happy to talk to you. I think we're going to go next to talk about some of the... to some of the more gendered aspects of all of this. We've been talking a little bit about how some of these experiences might be different for women and men in any particular community, but wanted to get into that a little bit more specifically. And maybe I could start by asking about, important aspect historically of the women's movement has been the sort of self-help group or consciousness-raising group where women share their experiences, can be experiences of violence, of sexual abuse, of other types of abuse, and in breaking through that silencing and isolation, women can deconstruct the idea of those being individual problems, and that's been a very important technique that's developed in that type of feminist movement. And I'm wondering if our panelists could just reflect on that, and I'd like to know whether you have any sort of formal or specific relationships with those types of feminist communities, or if those approaches resonate with you in any way, or is there anything common about those ideas about collectivizing an experience and sort of seeing it as a community thing, not just as an individual problem?
Certainly for psychiatric survivors, the psych survivor, what we call the psych survivor movement, originated in the 60s and 70s alongside the civil rights movement, feminist movement, where people who had been experiencing the psych system decided to say, hey, we're going to start creating things for ourselves. So they started to create spaces and groups and meetings where they got together to develop peer and grassroots approaches to some of their experiences of the world, or their experience of madness, and to begin to challenge the very system that was supposed to be helping them by challenging the labeling that was going on. So certainly peer grassroots work is absolutely key to embracing more madness in our society, I would say, because that's what's at stake, what's the issue for me is that we don't do that.
Michelle, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I'm busy writing these little points for myself. It does resonate, not specifically as in terms of feminism, because I think there are parallel developments, because I think also feminism looked at older forms of relating as well, and so many of our clients come from collective cultures where, if you have a problem, you go talk to the elder, or you go talk to the grandfather or grandmother or somebody in the community. And coming to Canada as a refugee and as a survivor of torture, those connections are destroyed. They're lost and or destroyed. And the healing process involves rebuilding that, but in a different way, because of course Canadian culture is going to be very different from the original culture. But the structure has to also, I mean, it doesn't have to, but the structure can be replicated. And we replicate that through, again, the use of the support groups and the counselors work with the clients, but also through volunteers, the replication of the larger community through the volunteer group. I also find that all of what Lucy has said resonates very much to our experience with the support groups. Except it doesn't seem to be so explicit, I've noticed so many times the women, don't talk about their experiences, but maybe there may be an oblique reference at some point, and then all of the women have the look, that look of understanding that they can do. There's a lot of nonverbal communication that's going on in the groups, and also you can see that in the intensity with which the group reacts when one member is dealing with a problem. For example, a counselor told me about this client who got an incredibly huge medical bill because she didn't know she wasn't covered under OHIP, and it was the group who helped facilitate that woman through the process. So that was very important, and powerful for the group to experience.
What I'd like to mention is that as survivors, we have an understanding with each other. Once they've gone through the first stage, the chaotic stage, and started to stabilize, and once their perceptions start to clear, we end up sharing with each other the similar situations and stories, and it's just like you become part of a family, and you understand that we're not alone. That's one of the biggest things that we understand, and that we can help each other.
And Lucy wants to say something.
I just thought of an example Michelle, you reminded me of something in a group, which may sound absurd to some people, but for us, this is an example of bonding or connecting in a peer kind of way. The experience of sitting around with a bunch of women talking about how you cut yourself up, you cut your arm, like you do self-mutilation stuff, and how we can relate to each other and why we do that, what it feels like to see the cuts, what it feels like to see blood. And to do that in a way where we're not freaked out, and in fact we can embrace that we do this behavior, because, for example, that would be something, behavior that would be seen as really problematic and really needing to be cured and drugged to stop that behavior. But put it in the context of psych survivors getting together and just talking about that, it becomes completely different. Same thing, I had an experience where I spoke to a crazy person like me, and we were talking about how we went through a period where we'd have to take all the books off the bookshelf and put them into piles and stack them into piles. Now, prior to that, I would never have spoken to anybody about that, but in speaking with a peer, I felt like, no, he totally understood what I was talking about, and it made total sense. So I just wanted to bring some concrete examples of madness to this discussion, because it makes it more visible.
I just, when I was listening, what that brought up for me is that what we see with some of our clients is that they develop coping skills because to survive the trauma and abuse that they've gone through. And there was four ways that we've noticed that are very common. And one of the first coping skills that they develop is one could be living in a fantasy world. Another one is the spirit leaves the body because it's no longer safe to be in the body, because the body's been invaded by an abuser. A third way is righteous anger, rage. It's often rooted in emotional pain or violation, and there's often a need for revenge. And a fourth way is self-mutilation, and also the physical numbing out of body parts to cope with their trauma and abuse.
Yeah, that's quite common with our clients too. And I've seen some samples through the art therapy sessions that have been held. One of the exercises or one of the tasks given to the client is draw a picture of what you want to do to your torturer. And some of it is very graphic. But afterwards, just doing that process, afterwards, the person feels much lighter, you know, that they would never in a million years do it in real life, but to go through that process and work out the anger and the rage at the person, it was very, very useful.
Sorry, I just want to say one more thing about this discussion this is how pervasive this stuff is, because as I'm sitting here, both Fran and Michelle, mm-hmm. you're using the term client, and it's just driving me up the wall. And whatever, word is a word. But it stems from a medicalization of experience, and mm-hmm. I'm not anybody's client. I never was anybody's mm-hmm. client, and I never will be anybody's client. Mm-hmm. And I think that, though I don't necessarily think Fran and Michelle are doing this, I think people that often use that language, it comes from they're the experts and you're the client, or in psychiatry, the patient.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a problematic way of working, because language is so strong, and it's the way we communicate with each other. And if the language is built into the language is power dynamics, I mean, I don't know. We should get people to call in with their points of view.
And the number let me give the number before you continue, is 416-595-1655.
And I agree with that. I should be using the term survivor. And the other thing is that when we work with the survivors, is that we're all equal. We don't think we're better because we're caretakers, or Rosalie doesn't believe she's better because she's a trauma facilitator. We're all equal. We're all human beings.
I think what has really come out of the discussion so far for me is that you're all describing experiences of extreme loss of control, whether someone is being tortured or sexually abused as a child or imprisoned in a psychiatric institution. What is horrific about it is to have absolutely no control, and that is replicated in these traditional treatments where you have an authoritarian kind of relationship between the expert and the client. So what is really empowering about your work is that you're, you know, changing that relationship, and it's about empowering and helping people take back that control. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, language is fluid. I use the word client because that's my relationship with clients, but when volunteers are matched up, then they are friends and they are students or teachers. And you're right, it's a problem. I mean, what do you call... We call clients survivors of torture, but our name is the Canadian Centre for Victims of Torture. Why victims and not survivors? Well, you know, our view is that everyone is a victim, not all have survived, and we speak on behalf of everyone. But, you know, victim, survivor, different connotation. Yeah, of course, we're very aware of the ambiguity and the power dynamics that are involved in labeling.
The other thing that we found with the work with the survivors is that each individual goes through victim pain and that they have to deal with, and they also go through an abuser pain. And those are two types of pain that they deal with as they go through this four-stage model of healing.
Can you explain the difference between those two types of pain?
Well, the victim pain is where they heal and they reclaim their power from their abuser, and there's often a need for revenge. And the abuser pain is where they look at their own, where they've been the abuser.
Mm-hmm. Just wanted to remind our listeners again, give us a call, 416-595-1655. And I just want to stop for a second. Audrey, I don't know why nobody's calling.
I don't know.
Because I really think that there's like a lot of experience in this room and on this panel of people who know a lot about serious stuff, you know, and just wanted to... you know, give people an opportunity to, you know, if you've got any questions about this, if there's people in your life that you care about that have these kinds of experiences, like, please do give us a call and give us some feedback on what we've been discussing. Again, 416-595-1655.
This is the number to call. And I mean, people may not be calling because generally these are subjects that are stigmatized and that are silenced, and that women in particular are not supposed to be talking about. So we're changing all that here on the air, live, CKLN, Special International Women's Day Programming.
In fact, I think, why don't we take a quick break and hear a couple messages, and we will be back in just a few moments. You're listening to CKLN.
Government's handling of the crisis at OCA was designed to try and humiliate and crush the warriors in order to send a clear message to Native people of color, and those that resist the state. Don't stand up for your rights or we will crush you. The object was not negotiation. It was humiliation and domination.
Call each other skin. I got it, I'm in there. Skin. white and who doesn't subscribe to European cultural values is automatically assumed to be inferior. Our lives are somehow less valuable. So it's acceptable to allow the army and the SQ to terrorize Indian people at Oka and for cops to gun down innocent black people in the streets.
And during the few moments that we have left, we wanna have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. Us. We wanna talk right down to earth. Right down to earth. In a language that everybody here can easily understand.
The last thing the Canadian government wants to see is black and native people asserting themselves and standing up for their rights together.
We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. But once we all realize that we have this common enemy,
listening to CKLN 88.1 FM. Mercedes Guignard. Born in 1935, Mercedes Guignard is one of the few Haitian women to have published both poetry and prose in Creole. She lived many years in the United States, where she was very active in literary circles, and returned to Haiti after the fall of the Duvalier dictatorship. She has spent her life dealing with written words in one way or another. As a librarian, a playwright, a director, a poet, a journalist, a publisher, a novelist, an author of folktales, and a lecturer. She's an authority on Haitian voodoo and folklore, and among her publications are Majou Diol poems, published in 1981, Nanchant plays, Espérance Désirée, a novel, all published in 1989, and Conte dans Jardin, Petit Thomas, folktales, published in 1991. Mercedes Guignard, Haitian poet.